Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. It's traditional to say at the end of our seders, next year in Jerusalem. But my suggestion is to consider this summer in Jerusalem, a summer at the Pardes Institute for Jewish Studies, where we have sessions of every length from 1 week, 2 week, and 3 week sessions, plus sessions can be combined for a longer study if you wish. The sessions are open to every adult from late teens, 18, 19 years old, through people in their 70s and 80s, and everyone has attended the sessions in the past. Full information is available on the web at www.pardes.org.il/summer and also /exec, E-X-E-C, which describes our one-week executive seminar program. It will be a terrific time. I urge you to make plans to study with us in Pardes at this summer in Jerusalem. Also, if you're leading a trip or if you'll be part of an organized trip, I urge you to discuss with your organizers to have a study session at Pardes that would be customized for your trip. The main requirement is that the session needs to be at least a half day. The session can include lunch or breakfast if you wish. That would be catered through the Pardes in-house, our in-house chef. Studying Torah in Jerusalem touches both the mind and the heart of all the participants and is regularly seen by participants of these sessions as being the best part of their trip to Israel, whether it was their first trip or a veteran of many trips to Israel. So please get in touch with us if you have any questions about that. This week, Rabbi Schweiger discusses Parshat Kiddushim. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. There is a handout for this podcast, which I'm sending as the next podcast file, so be sure to check that out and print it out as you listen along from with Rabbi Meir Schweiger. And now, Rabbi Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parashat Kedoshim. In another podcast, I discussed how the theme of the book of Vayikra is how we become a holy people. Vayikra begins with the sacrifices, with laws of ritual purity and impurity that are all relevant to the temple, tabernacle. But at the end of last week's parsha, and certainly in our parsha, there is a dramatic switch from the tabernacle to everyday life. Ultimately, the test of our holiness is not reflected in the temple, but in our relationships with each other. And that is why Parshat Kedoshim is filled with numerous laws, ben adam l'chaveiro, of interpersonal relationships. I would like to examine one particular law, which is in Vayikra chapter 19, verse 14. Lifnei iver lo titein michshol. Do not place an obstacle before the blind. I have attached a sheet of sources, and I will be reading from the sheet. For those of you who are able to download, you can follow me as I go along. For those of you who cannot, I hope that it will be clear enough so that my message gets across. My first reference is from the Sifra. Sifra, the Midrash Halacha, on the book of Vayikra. Do not place an obstacle before the blind. And the rabbis interpret this as before one who is blind in the matter. If one comes to you for advice, don't give him advice which is inappropriate. Do not say to him, go out early in the morning, in order that robbers should cut him down, or go out in the afternoon, in order that he faint from heat exhaustion. Don't say to him, sell your field and buy a mule, and then you circumvent him and take the mule from him. And take the field from him. Perhaps you will say, but I gave him good advice. Behold, the matter is given over to the heart. as it is said, and you shall fear your God. I am Hashem. Let me begin by noting that in all of the rabbinic interpretations and applications of this verse, the rabbis understand it in a metaphoric way. The rabbis did not relate to the literal meaning of the verse. As if to say, the literal meaning of the verse perhaps is obvious, but the rabbis dealt with many situations that are more complex, that reflect the complexity of human relationships. This first interpretation understands someone who is blind as one who is blind in the matter. To rephrase it, one who is ignorant. The best example that we could give nowadays, is someone who goes into a store shopping, perhaps wanting to purchase appliances. With so many different things on the market, people feel inadequate. They just don't know what features should I really be looking for. And as someone who is ignorant, you turn to the person who ostensibly is the expert and ask them for advice. What should I buy? Let's take an example. I am now going into a store trying to buy a computer, many different types of brands, Toshiba, Hewlett-Packard, IBM, Sony, Dual-Core, Celeron, different types of memory. And I now ask the person, so what do you recommend? At that moment, I am in a position of tremendous vulnerability. And the person who is selling can exploit my vulnerability. They can go on and on telling me the virtues of a particular computer and how this is the best top of the line that you can possibly get. But maybe I don't need the top of the line. Maybe they're telling me that because this is where they make the most money. And it's very interesting that at the end of the drash, they say, well, but the person can always claim the seller. But I gave him good advice. Therefore, the end of the verse, which speaks about do not place an obstacle before the blind, says, V'yareta me'elokecha, ani Hashem. You should fear your God, I am Hashem. To misquote Abe Lincoln, you can fool some of the people all the time, all the people some of the time. You can even fool yourself most of the time, but you can never fool God. This mitzvah of not placing an obstacle before the blind is something which is very much given over to one's heart. Who's to know what the seller is really thinking? Who's to know what is really motivating him when he gives over his information? So what should one do in such a situation? It would seem to be that there are a number of tips which would avoid this pitfall of an obstacle before the blind. The first thing, whatever information you give to someone has to be totally accurate. In no way can you exaggerate any point. Number two, it is important for the person to realize the pros and cons. If I tell someone this is top of the line, but it also should be brought to the person's attention, it costs three times the amount. It could be that there's a certain model which has many, many positive features, but it's a laptop. It's very heavy. And I'm the type of person who needs greater mobility. So that it is incumbent upon the seller to lay out all the facts. In an ideal situation, to say these are the facts, to let the person decide for themselves, now that they've been informed, to make their own decision. And if you had a situation where the person says, but nevertheless, I find it hard to decide, help me, then the one who is selling should really put themselves in the shoes, in the mindset of the one who is buying, and really ask themselves again and again, what is in the best interest of that individual. It takes a tremendous effort for someone to be looking out for someone else's interest and not their own. And in the example which I just gave, it is very easy for someone to cover their tracks, to be able to say, but I really thought I was giving you the best advice. Example number one. Let us skip down to a further example. This will be 3, 4, and 5. Rav Huna tore silk garments in the presence of Rabba, his son. He said, let me see if he will boil in rage or not. And then the rabbis of the Talmud ask, but perhaps he will boil, and Rav Huna will thereby be violating, do not place an obstacle. And the rabbis answer, he, Rav Huna, was willing to forego his honor. And maybe if I go to number 4, in the same vein, the maid of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi once saw a man that was hitting his adult son. She said, may that man be excommunicated, since he is violating, do not place an obstacle. As the rabbis taught in a braita, do not place an obstacle, the text refers to one who hits his adult son. And Rashi, the classic commentary on the Talmud, points out, since the son is an adult, perhaps he will kick his father, and hence the father is creating an obstacle before him. These two examples illustrate a principle which is very, very common. Parents educating their children. And I want to go back to our first example. Our first example of the salesman was a situation where the salesman could very well have malicious intent. And what in effect the Torah is saying is, be honest. Whose interest are you really looking out for? Are you looking out for your own interest or for the buyer's interest? When someone comes to you for advice, don't exploit your position of power. On the contrary, try to empower that individual. Try to empathize with that individual. To as much as possible, look out for the well-being of that needy person. The two examples which I have now given you that has to do with parents and children are not talking about malicious parents. They're both talking about well-meaning parents. Parents who are trying to educate their children. In one case, Rav Huna is tearing up his son's garments. If we put it in modern terms, he takes his stereo and smashes it. Why is he doing it? He's testing him to see to what degree does he have self-control. Will the son be able to restrain himself and not curse his father, not hit his father? One could even say that Rav Huna perhaps knew his son. If I take this as a kind of analogy to God testing Abraham, that he wants to show his son how strong he can be, how he can somehow restrain himself and not react. But the Talmud says, what if Rav Huna is wrong? What if the son is not capable of exercising self-restraint and lashes out at his father? The son will then be violating the commandment to honor one's parents. And Rav Huna set it up. He created the obstacle. He put the son in a position which is going to cause him to sin. So that the obstacle over here is the moral difficulty, dilemma that the son is presented with. And the Talmud then says, in typical fashion, Rav Huna basically said in advance, no matter what the son does, I forgive him. And therefore, in effect, he foregoed his honor so that even if the son did something wrong, he's not violating the lack of honor that he is showing to his parents. The second example of a father who's smacking his son. My sense from the context is that we're not talking about an abusive parent. We're talking about a parent who feels that this is perhaps a legitimate educational mode to discipline his child. And right now, I'm not interested in getting into the whole question of whether hitting children is valid, is it not valid. But let's assume we have a parent who feels that this is what he needs to do to educate his child. And what this is saying is, when you have an adult child, do not do it, because there's a good chance that he will react in a negative way, and you provoked it. What are these two examples showing us? And as I mentioned earlier, this reflects the complexity of what does it mean to be holy. Even in a situation where someone may have good intentions, they have to think through the full ramifications of what they're doing, because it could lead to a very negative result. I am sure those of us who are parents can certainly recall many situations where we may have felt that what we were doing was correct educationally, but where perhaps we didn't think it through to the end, and where maybe had we thought a little bit more, we would have realized that what we were doing would be totally counterproductive. Rather than educating our children, rather than elevating our children, we were alienating our children. So that when we speak about putting an obstacle before the blind, it's not enough to just be well-intentioned, but one has to think through the ramifications. And if I bring the next example, number 5, which is not so far-fetched. There was once a child from Bnei Brak who broke a jug. When his father pointed to him with his ear, he became afraid of him, went away, and committed suicide in a pit. Based on this, the rabbi said, one should never point to a child with his ear. Rather, one should either hit him immediately or be silent and not say anything. Once again, a fascinating example. One has a child that is acting up, that has just done something which is obnoxious. And then the parent looks at the child and says, wait till we get home, in a very threatening way. The example that's given is that the child went and committed suicide. What about a situation where a child doesn't commit suicide but runs away? Or maybe does something else that is stupid that in the end could be very hurtful to the child? Once again, this example shows us how careful parents have to be in their reactions to their children's behavior, in their attempt to educate their children, how much they have to anticipate what could be possible reactions, responses, and to somehow prevent negative responses. Let me go back to the second reference, which also takes this idea of not placing an obstacle to another realm. Graves must be marked off. Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi said, from where in the Torah do we have a hint that graves need to be marked off? Abaye said, from the verse, do not place an obstacle. We know that Kohanim are not allowed to come in contact with the dead. They are not allowed to become ritually impure as a result of that contact. If a Kohen were to walk over a grave, he would become defiled. If a grave is not marked off, it can become an obstacle to the Kohen. So what is this telling us? It's saying not only should I not create an obstacle, but I should be proactive in removing obstacles. If there is a grave, I must see to it that it is marked off so that it does not become an obstacle to the Kohen. So if we think for a moment, the progression that we had from reference one to the last one, the first thing is that it is very important for someone to be honest with themselves. What is motivating me? To really try to think of the well-being of the person who is in need. The first thing is I do not exploit my position of power. The second thing, even when I'm well-intentioned, that's not enough. But I have to really think through a situation. and certainly something which I could have anticipated. In the end, I am held responsible for. And the last example of the grave. I need to be proactive in removing obstacles. In all the examples we had, there is an idea of empowering someone who is in a position of weakness. I empower them through knowledge. I empower them morally by not creating a provocation that can lead to their moral / holy demise. Let us look at another example, reference number 6, following a similar type of approach. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, anyone who has money and lends it without witnesses transgresses the verse, and you shall not place an obstacle before the blind. And Rashi on the spot says, because it enters the mind of the borrower to deny. Once again, let us examine the complexity of this situation. I have a friend, a close friend, who wants to borrow money. And I want to show that friend how much I care about them, how much I trust them. So I say, sure, here's $100, here's $1,000, take it. Comes along Rav Yehuda and says, you should do this in front of witnesses. And then the lender says, what do you mean I should do it in front of witnesses? If I do it in front of witnesses, that's insulting to my friend. He will be offended. He will say, what kind of friend? What's the matter? You don't trust me? So that when I want to lend money without witnesses, I am purely motivated. I am really trying to preserve the dignity of my friend, to show him how much I trust him. Comes along Rav Yehuda and says, all of that is true, but if you look a little bit down the line, you ultimately are showing that person respect by doing this in the presence of witnesses. Because by doing that, you are guaranteeing that that person will not be tempted to not pay you back. I am sure that many of us have had situations where we have tried to be very nice to some people, to lend them money, maybe even to lend them things. And for whatever reason, we never got back our money or got back whatever we lent somebody. In some cases, it could be that some people might take advantage of our goodness. As it says over here, it will enter the mind of the borrower to deny. But in other cases, it could be that there's negligence, forgetfulness. You come a few months later and the person says, I don't remember ever borrowing money from you. And it could be that they truly don't remember it. But had you written something down, had the person sign it, had you done it in the presence of two witnesses, then they would have to acknowledge that they really did borrow the money. So what do we see from this example? Even where it seems to be intuitive that what I should do is lend without witnesses, if one were to take it one more step, you would see that ultimately it's in everybody's best interest to have witnesses. Because that way there's no room for ambiguity. That way there's no room for temptation. That way everybody knows exactly where they stand, which ultimately is the good, is for the good of all the parties involved. I don't need to emphasize the common expression that it's not a good idea to do business with friends. It's not a good idea to do business with friends when I'm involved in a business situation and we act as friends. When we're in a business situation, we should act as business people. In the positive sense, even friends should draw up contracts, should have witnesses, just so that there is no misunderstanding. And even though at face value, it seems to be a negation of our relationship of trust, in the long run, it will preserve our relationship. I want to look at two more references, number 9, 10, and then conclude with number 11, which I think is an appropriate way of ending our discussion. In number 9, Maimonides codifies the following law. It is forbidden to sell weapons of warfare to idolaters. We do not sharpen their instruments. One should not sell them knives, collars, stockades, metal cuffs, metal chains, bears, lions, or any object that can cause harm to the public. One can sell them shields for defensive purposes. Just as it is prohibited to sell to idolaters, so is it prohibited to sell to Jews who sell to idolaters. And in the next halakha, Maimonides says, so too is it prohibited to sell these things to Jewish criminals, because in doing so one strengthens the hands of transgressors and creates an obstacle for them. This halakha gets you into a whole realm of selling things to people who will use it in an abusive way, in particular weapons. We could extend this to selling cigarettes, to selling alcohol, to selling drugs. In all of these situations, I am creating an obstacle. I am selling something to someone which they will use in an abusive way, abusive to themselves, abusive to other people. And one cannot come along and say, they're adults, they can decide whatever they want to do, they have free will. I'm not pushing them in whatever they're doing. One could even say, in some cases, who's to say that they will necessarily use it abusively? It is very interesting that the Maimonides makes a distinction between offensive weapons and defensive weapons. Defensive weapons are okay, but offensive weapons, or things that potentially could be offensive weapons, one cannot sell, and one cannot make the claim, how could I have known that they would do such and such? But maybe that's something which you could very easily anticipate. Anyone who I have any reason to suspect could potentially use what I'm selling in an abusive way, I should beware of giving them the means to do so. And once again, this brings us back to our first example, where somebody could say, I had no clue what they were going to do with it. I was sure they were going to use it for something constructive. And that's why I sold it to them. But maybe you're selling it to them because you're making a lot of money on this. So this somehow brings us back to our first reference, closing a circle, and once again showing how placing an obstacle before the blind is a very, very practical day-to-day halakha. And now let's look at the last two references. Number 10. In the Shulchan Aruch, it is brought down, one should give food only to someone who he knows will make a blessing. Fascinating halakha. And the Rama, who is the Ashkenazi authority, says, and there are those who are lenient in a case of charity. I'll come back to that in a moment. But very interestingly, according to Jewish law, whenever someone eats anything, they should make a blessing beforehand, and if they eat a certain quantity, make a blessing afterwards. What if I know that the person that I am inviting to dinner does not make blessings? It could be because they don't believe in God. It could be because they don't feel that this is something which is what God wants them to do. It's totally irrelevant why they don't make blessings. So now here I invite them to my house. I'm inviting them to my house because I'm being nice. I want to show hospitality. And what is this saying? But here, in trying to be nice and showing hospitality, you are creating an obstacle because you are now going to put the person in a situation where they will do something which is a desecration. They will eat without making a blessing. And once again, we are given a complex situation where I am motivated by something very, very positive, but it could be that I am provoking, I am causing a negative type of behavior. And hence this is saying, if you know that the person will not make a blessing, do not give them food. My last reference is from Responsa of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach of sainted memory, who is perhaps the leading Ashkenazi posek, decider of the law in Israel. He passed away a number of years ago. And this responsa perhaps sums up our discussion. He begins by saying, one should always assess his ways and direct his actions for the sake of heaven. It seems to me that in a situation where one is hosting an important guest who is not observant, but has a love for Torah scholars, supports Torah institutions, were the host to act in an inappropriate manner and not offer his guest something to eat or drink, because of the halakha, that it is prohibited to give food to one who will not make a blessing. Or furthermore, were the host to respectfully ask his guest to wash his hands and make a blessing, and the guest would take offense and see this as an insult to his dignity, and thus be very angered by such a move, and perhaps as a result even become alienated from the Torah, become contemptuous of observant Jews. In such a case, it would seem that it would be proper to honor him with food and drink, and not be concerned about violating "do not place an obstacle." Because in fact, if you do not give him to eat, you will cause an even greater obstacle. It will end up that there is no transgression, because rather than placing an obstacle, you are in fact saving him from a very great obstacle by giving him food and doing a small obstacle. What is the situation? And I want to make it clear that it isn't for those people who might be cynical, because the question was raised regarding hosting somebody who was a big donor to a yeshiva, and where the concern is, how do I treat them because in the end I might lose their donation? This question is relevant in any situation, and I think that the principle is a very, very important principle. I invite somebody to my house. They do not make blessings on the food. I know that. So what do? I open up the Shulchan Aruch and it says, well, if they don't make blessings, don't give them any food. So I could just say, you know what? Either I don't invite this person, or I'll invite them, but I won't give them any food, because I know they won't make a blessing. Or maybe what I'll do is I'll suggest to them, oh, now it is time. We all go and we wash our hands before we eat bread. So let us go wash. Let us now make a blessing on the bread. And my guest goes, sure, go ahead. Or what happens if my guest says, why do you Orthodox Jews always have to be so coercive, so self-righteous? What should I do? Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is saying, one always has to look at the particular situation and ask themselves, what would God want me to do? What in the end will bring about the best result? What in the end will create the least damage? What is worse? Is it worse that this person was now given food and did not make a blessing? Or is it worse that I either did not give them food or said something about making a blessing and either way insulted them, and by insulting them, totally alienated them from Judaism so that they don't want to have anything to do with Judaism, with Torah? So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is saying, you always have to see the forest for the trees. There isn't a set, pat answer. And this is what characterizes being holy. Being holy means I can't just look it up in a book and this is the answer. But it means that I have to learn how to weigh different concerns. I have to think through a situation. I have to be able to put myself in the other person's position and say to myself, what in the end that I am doing will provoke the best response of that individual? What will in the end bring out the best in that person? In the example that we just had, if I host that person, if I invite them into my home for a Shabbat, then they will now perhaps get an appreciation of Shabbat. They will get an appreciation of hospitality. And perhaps they will come out with a feeling, oh, Shabbat is really nice. Giving of oneself is really a great thing to do. But if I insist on the person making a blessing, then maybe what I'm doing is giving a message that can say that there are always strings attached. There's always a certain element of self-righteousness. That's the model that you're generating to me. One always has to put themselves in the position of the receiver and ask themselves, having done what I've done, will that bring out the best in that person or the worst in that person? And even when I might think that what I'm doing is going to bring out the best, I might be mistaken. And therefore, I really have to think this through very, very carefully. I have taken this one example today. I hope in future years we will do many other examples to perhaps illustrate that the realm of interpersonal relationships many times can be much more complex than one's relationship with God. It is perhaps much easier to deal with a God who is much more understanding, who is much more compassionate, who's much more stable than human beings, where it is very difficult to know how they will react, and certainly where they may be much less understanding and accommodating. And therefore, I have to be the one who has to be really looking out for their well-being. As I mentioned in reference number 2, not placing an obstacle is not just about what I don't do. It is also about what I actively do. Not only should I not place obstacles, but I should really make every effort to remove obstacles, to break down the barriers, to empower the other, to as much as possible put myself and the other person on the same side of the fence. This is what it means to be kedoshim tihyu. This is what it means to create a holy congregation, a holy nation. May we learn through our simple day-to-day actions how to truly think of the other, to empower them, and as a result of that, become a model for the world to emulate. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always important to us. Please let us know any thoughts and comments by email at podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.